Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Before I go any further, I should mention that we're going to be talking about all sorts of things that you might be able to eat that are actually good for you and tasty, but also we're going to be focusing on longevity and brain preservation as our main topics this hour. Well, you probably noticed that the weather here in Santa Cruz and other counties nearby has been very weird. It was front page story today in all of the newspapers, weird weather fluctuations. I wonder if that has something to do with the ocean temperatures changing. That one pretty much is indisputable, whether you figure out where it's coming from. I'm not up for having that debate today. But one of the things that we're experiencing here in the Monterey Bay is an increase in our ocean temperature, and therefore a real bloom of jellyfish. Jellyfish are very adaptable. They're extremely primitive organisms, and they are doing just fine, thank you very much, in the warmer water that is giving some other creatures a bit of trouble. So, as I thought to myself when I read that a few months ago, we'd better figure out how to eat jellyfish. And of course, in Asia, they've been eating jellyfish for thousands of years, but it's never really taken off here because it's sort of, like a really gristly beef jerky without the beef flavor, so no one really likes it. However, a gastrophysicist from the University of Southern Denmark, I never heard of a gastrophysicist before, have you? Has developed a new method for drying jellyfish to the point where it loses all that gristly, chewy quality and becomes paper thin and crunchy, just like a potato chip. This was just published in the International Journal of Gastronomy and Food Science Tests. This is a real breakthrough. It takes a long time to make the dried jellyfish that they make in Asia, and you probably couldn't get Americans to eat it anyway. But Dr. Peterson's technique takes only a few days. They basically soak the jellyfish in alcohol, and the alcohol replaces the water in the jellyfish, and then they evaporate off the alcohol, and you end up with little crunchy jellyfish crisps, which really don't have much of a flavor, but they taste okay. And to quote Dr. Peterson, the mouthfeel and aesthetic appearance have gastronomic appeal. So it would not surprise me, since we are now, at least I, am eating kelp chips, although I wish they were cheaper. My goodness, they're expensive. Why not see us someday soon eating jellyfish chips? Maybe put a little jalapeno on mine, if you please. And we're going to go to our next story, which is moderate drinking is linked to cognitive health in old age. And this was a really well-done study out of the University of San Diego. And what they found was that older adults who consume alcohol moderately on a regular basis are more likely to live to the age of 85 without dementia or other cognitive impairments than non-drinkers or binge drinkers. The findings were in the August Journal of the Alzheimer's Disease. This was the August issue Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Previous studies had found a correlation between alcohol intake and longevity, but this study is pretty unique because they looked at cognitive health later in life and found that alcohol consumption was not only associated with living longer, but with greater chances of remaining cognitively intact into old age. Now, this was a 29-year study. They used the Mini Mental Status Exam, which is a validated way of looking at mental health, and they used and that was their dementia test. That's a pretty good test to use. Every 4 years for 29 years, and this group of about 1,300 older adults, 700 and change of women, 600 and change of men, all lived in Rancho Bernardo, which is a upper to middle class suburb in San Diego County. And they managed, because, hey, that's a really good place to live,
after you retire, so you tend to stay put. 99% of the study participants were tracked from 1984 to 2013. Most of them, because it's San Diego County and it's upper middle class, were Caucasian with at least some college education. The people who were the heavy drinkers the moderate drinkers had the best benefit, but even heavy drinkers were still better off than people who didn't drink at all. And I found that fascinating. So I'm sure you want to know, what's moderate constitute? For women, it's one alcoholic beverage a day. And for men, also, if you're over 65, one drink a day. And if you're an adult man under 65, it was two drinks a day. And then heavy drinking was three alcoholic beverages for any woman or men 65 or older, or four drinks a day for adult men under 65. Now, I always take an alcohol history from my patients when I do their physicals, and I always figure they're subtracting one off of the number of drinks they have per day. And maybe some of them aren't, but of course, certainly the ones who say one or two a month, I believe. But for the daily drinkers, if you can keep it below four drinks, you have a good chance of not frying your brain. And this was daily drinking. I don't know if you could have two on one day and one on the next, but since they were using a long-term study and averages, I suspect that would be okay as well. So you probably don't have to drink every day, but it's really interesting to see a study like this well done. And it certainly gave me pause to think, well, not so bad after all, Don, because I definitely do enjoy the not so occasional glass of wine. Let's go to our next story. And this is a drug reboot. This is an agent called exenatide. It is trade name Byetta. It's given by injection, and it's commonly used for diabetes. It's been around for a long time. Let's see, I think it was released in the early 2000s, and it's given by injection once weekly. It's helpful for diabetes, but this study was a placebo trial, and it showed benefit in patients with Parkinson's disease. It was funded by the Michael J. Fox Foundation, not by the manufacturer, so that's a plus. And they had a placebo. People got a shot once a week of exenatide, or they got a placebo along with their regular medications. And then at 48 weeks, they tested them as they came off the treatment, and then they tested them at 12 weeks after that. And what they showed was a statistically significant improvement, or rather lack of deterioration, which is the usual story in Parkinson's disease, compared to the controls. So how does this drug, which is an extract of Gila Monster spit, or actually derived, I should say, they stole the molecule and then started to make it artificially. How does it work? Well, we know that it activates something called GLP-1 hormone in the pancreas. That's glucose-like peptide 1. There are also GLP-1 receptors in the brain. And there's been some prior research that showed that if you can activate them, they act as an anti-inflammatory. They switch on cell survival signals, which, of course, you need to keep those cells. In Parkinson's, people lose them. And it also actually boosts the function of the dopamine synapses themselves. And there were some prior animal studies, but this is the first human study. And because this drug is already FDA approved, and this study is at least promising, I think that we will probably start to see some people going to this off-label. And certainly more studies are in the offing, because we're very eager to do something about Parkinson's disease. It's very dangerous and very difficult to treat. So stay tuned. I'll keep you posted on that. And if you've got Parkinson's disease, you might want to ask your doctor about Gila Monster spit and whether it's right for you. I want to tell you about a new kind of sunscreen that's in the offing. Has a little bit of a news of the weird feel to it, but certainly is going to have low side effects. So researchers at Birmingham universities and State of University of New York have developed a coating, a skin coating that's made out of DNA. And the cool thing about this is the longer you stay out in the sun, the better it works. And just for booster's sake, it also helps keep skin hydrated. So ultraviolet light actually damages DNA. I'm quoting Guy German, assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Birmingham University, biomechanical. So we thought, hey, let's flip it. What happens instead if we actually used DNA as a sacrificial layer? So instead of damaging DNA within the skin, we damage a layer on top of the skin. Well, Dr. German and a team developed a thin, optically transparent crystalline DNA film, and the more that they were exposed to UVA light, the better they got at absorbing it, rather like a photographic negative, if you think about it, once people actually can use an exposed bit of photographic film to block light. See, that's how the old way we used to make photos works. So they made a topical cream, and indeed, the longer you stay at the beach, the better it gets as a sunscreen. I can't wait to try that. Another thing that this might really work well as, because it's transparent, is a wound healing gel. So you would be able to track how your wound was doing without peeling off the Band-Aid, and it does adhere to skin very well. And you would also protect your wound from the sun, which is excellent, because if you get sun on a scar, it tends to pigment more. And it would keep the wound moist, because it holds in moisture. Plus, it could be in a tube, so I can see us carrying around our DNA sunscreen in not too many years from now, and also using it on cuts and scrapes. So interesting to see what these guys in the white coat come up with. I love science, and I hope you're enjoying these stories. And we're going to read an email or two right now. All right, so this first one is from Keith in Greenville. A friend of mine was bitten 6 years ago by a spider. The bite was on the top of the foot by the ankle. No necrosis took place, only swelling. She treated the bite with various home remedies for 3 weeks without any decrease of the swelling and began having some aches and heart palpitations, so she went to the emergency room. They were able to identify fang marks, and they thought that it was a big black widow spider that had pumped a lot of venom into her foot. The doctors said something that was quite toxic. Really sorry the doctors said this. They said, it might take years for the toxin to be removed from your body. Well, maybe that was a head trip for the lady, but once a year, when the seasons change from hot to cold, she has aching and palpitations that somehow she feels are linked to the foot. And one time, she felt like a nerve was pulling from the base of her spine down the back of that calf to the foot. They ended up working her up for a blood clot, so it was fairly substantial, and everything was fine. But 6 years later, she still has a swollen foot. What are your opinions? Thanks, Keith. Well, Keith, I looked up the late sequelae of spider bites, and I found something very interesting. There appears to be the potential for permanent nerve damage from black widow spider bites. And the case that was reported in the literature was a man who was bitten on the hand, and the venom from the bite actually, over several months, migrated up his arm into the autonomic nervous system, which is the one that controls things like pupillary dilation and salivation and all of our involuntary things like digestion, and gave the person Horner syndrome, which is a dilated single eye that was permanent. So the idea that the autonomic nervous system can be affected by the black widow spider bite is an established thing. So the palpitations that she experiences, and certainly the aching with changes in the weather, are not at all surprising. It's probable that this is permanent nerve damage, but there are some things that I'm going to recommend dietarily that we use for diabetic neuropathy. And I see no reason not to give them a try. They're things that are useful One of them, a couple of them are drugs, and one of them is a antioxidant. So being Dr. Don, I'm going to start with the antioxidant, and that is something called alpha-lipoic acid. Now, all you diabetics out there, you should be considering using alpha-lipoic acid because the product itself is very effective in preventing neuropathy from developing. And if you're a diabetic and your hemoglobin A1C is above 7, you're at risk for neuropathy and should probably be doing something about it. The dose is about 300 milligrams to 600 milligrams. I use the 600 milligrams for people who already have neuropathy and the 300 for people who don't and want to prevent it. A simple way to test for neuropathy is to take a tuning fork. And by the way, all you moderate to heavy drinkers out there, you might want to do this as well, since neuropathy at the tips of the toes is also going to happen to you if you don't get enough B vitamins because alcohol depletes them. Anyway, if you can find a tuning fork, you're going to strike it and put the tuning fork on the top of the toe, right at the toenail, and put your finger underneath the toe. Index finger is what I use. And when you can no longer feel the vibration on the top of the toe, the question to ask is, can I still feel it on the finger? And for how long? And if you can feel it on the finger for more than 5 seconds after you stop feeling it on the top of the toe, you've already got some mild neuropathy. Now, when I do this test, I find it positive, mildly positive, in about 10% of my patients. The first thing I do is look in their mouth and see if they've got any silver amalgam fillings, because then I'm worried about checking their metal levels for mercury and lead, for that matter. So I ask them about soldering. And the second thing I do is check a hemoglobin A1C, which is a good screening test for diabetes, to see if they've got a low-grade case that hasn't been identified. A third thing to think about is other things, and so that's just about anything, but black widow spider bites are probably on the list. So hope you enjoyed that long explanation to a very interesting email. This email from Peter in Vero Beach, Florida. Your review of Dr. Dale Bredesen on June 17th show was very timely, as my wife is showing early signs of dementia and has a family history. My understanding of dementia is that there are two broad sources, multi-infarct vascular clogging and Alzheimer's. Dr. Bredesen's study seems to be focusing on amyloid beta build up associated with Alzheimer's, though his treatment plan seems to focus on reduction of inflammation, which may be a root cause of both disease states. Were Bredesen study subjects screened for Alzheimer's, or were they mixed as just general dementia? I have reason to believe my wife is of the clogged brain vascular type. My question, would the treatment plans applied in his study be reasonable to follow for a person experiencing dementia that is most likely to be the result of vascular problems in the brain? So just to bring you up to speed on that, folks, you can go to the AskDrDon.com website and look for that June 17 2017 show and listen to it. It's a monologue show where I talk about the program. Some things, exercise and meditation will probably work. I would focus on things that move blood. So ginkgo, hawthorn, maybe some nitrate containing products like beets or L-arginine. These will all increase blood flow to the brain. There's a drug called Trentol that increases the flexibility of the blood vessels, the red blood cells, so it might help perfuse the brain a little better. So I'd be going in that direction. So a little bit of what Dr. Bredesen's doing, but also some other things as well. So we're going to pick up our caller. This is Richard with a question about Epstein-Barr. Hello, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just curious. Epstein-Barr virus, I researched it for a number of decades, but I was just wondering, they recently rephrased, it's no longer chronic fatigue syndrome, it's some kind of exertional something or whatever, and I was just wondering, do you know if the virus continues to be a factor in chronic fatigue syndrome, like Epstein-Barr virus? What do you know about CFS as it exists today?
This is a great question. Thank you for asking it, Richard. So another terminology that's emerging is chronic inflammatory response syndrome. And going back, to the early 90s, maybe even the 80s, probably started in the 80s, this thing called the yuppie flu, which was thought to be, which was a chronic fatigue syndrome that occurred after Epstein-Barr virus, we thought. And the reason we thought that was that people who complained of chronic fatigue had high levels of Epstein-Barr virus in their system. Later on, we also discovered that they had high levels of cytomegalovirus, and if they had had HPV, that is to say herpes virus, often their levels of that bumped from previous levels. And it's actually an overstimulation of the plasma cells that make antibodies against viruses. So whatever you got, you will have a bump in your antibody levels. And we now conceptualize this disease as being triggered by a multitude of different types of insults. Infections, including Lyme disease, can set people off. Mold toxins can set people off and get this rolling. And once it's rolling, the person experiences something called the push-crash syndrome. So they'll be tired and fatigued and barely able to get through their day, or even not able to get through their day. And then one day they'll wake up and they'll have a little more energy. So they'll try to exercise. They'll try to do something else. Maybe go to the market or like I said, ride a bicycle. And what happens is the next day they're just completely wiped out. If they push it all, they're just toast for days. It takes them days to get back to their baseline. So they become very adverse to exercise. And there's a great deal of controversy going on right now because the standard medical therapy or suggestion for this is that people exercise a little more each day. And a lot of people in the alternative world who believe that this is linked to a problem with the mitochondria, the cell's energy generation cells, are grabbing their heads and saying, no, that's absolutely the wrong thing to tell people to do. So there's a lot of back and forth between the medical establishment and the alternative people with respect to how best to manage this disease. But I will say that the medical establishment and the alternative world are both on board with the idea that this is kicked off by either a virus or some other exposure, but then it becomes a self-perpetuating problem. And that gets mixed in with Lyme disease, and gosh, it's just a mess. It's like finding that the kitten's gotten loose in the yarn basket and is just gotten everything all blended. So I don't have a lot of clarity to offer you, but I hope that at least helps with your question.
Yeah, just one last question. They're cutting the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, Atlanta, Georgia, U.S. CDC. They're cutting the funding for research into like these emergent diseases. And yeah. I was just wondering, what do you have any final comments about that? Do you think Donald Trump has any real concerns about things like CFS, you know, whatever you want to call it?
Emergent diseases. Well, I think that unfortunately our president, being a kind of robber baron himself and having that mentality, views the American public as a food animal, something to be exploited. Maybe, you know, let's clip off the wool and make sweaters for our children. Let's allow our cronies to suck a little blood out every day. And, you know, when they get old, let's just kill them. Let's just, you know, sacrifice them and turn them into dog food. I don't believe he has a much concern for us. I haven't seen it, at least. And I think he's got a lot of self-concern. And I think he believes quite correctly that as he'll be protected from the consequences of just about any of his actions as president. It'll be interesting to see whether there are any consequences for any of his actions. I feel like things move so slowly that the chances you know, looking at what's going on in Brazil and, you know, other countries that are, we just hear hearing today about Israel, you know, by the time the indictment winds its way through the courts, the person will have been out of office forever and the damage is done. So I think we need to resist. I was walking down Pacific last night in Santa Cruz and I saw a bunch of hats and said that on it. And I honestly think we need to make it extremely painful. We need to reach out to our friends and neighbors and relatives in, well, not ex-neighbors maybe, in red states. We need to make sure that people have the facts and have the information about the consequences of these budget cuts, which I think could lead to us not being prepared to respond to something terrible, like a major disaster, like a bioterror weapon. I mean, it's a very frightening time right now to be alive, and particularly to be in this country. And I do a lot. It's been very good for me because I have to meditate every day, and that's actually improved my cognitive skills quite substantially. Meditation helps you think better, so I recommend it to you. And I thank you again for the call. It was a good question. And I'm going to read my next email. And this one was from Karen in Santa Cruz. Hey, Karen. I hear a lot about heavy metals contributing to health issues. Is there a specific test you recommend to determine if you have heavy metal toxicity? And of course, this is email number 3 because it dovetails with what I said about email number 2, and I love that when I can do that. The idea that we've got a real issue with how our environment is influencing our health. And unfortunately, those coal-burning power plants that everyone is so enthusiastic about put a lot of mercury into the air because there's mercury in the coal. And once it gets up into the atmosphere, it comes down as rain and it enters the water table. It also enters the ocean. In the ocean, it is changed by bacteria in the ocean floor, and it becomes something that can be accumulated biologically. Now, pure mercury will go right through you, but transformed or organified mercury will actually stick, and it will stick to your body fat. And so the fish have the mercury. When they eat the algae and the bacteria, it sticks to their body fat. The next fish that eats that fish gets more, and it accumulates. So by the time you get to large predator fish like tuna or swordfish, you in some fisheries are looking at very, very high mercury levels. Now, mercury poisoning, like they had in Japan many years ago, when mercury was being dumped into the ocean, these people had severe neurological damage that was very apparent. But low-level toxicity doesn't cause anything you can really see that easily. And as medical doctors, we're taught to spot poisoning, but we're not taught to spot this subtle neuropathy or some of these other problems. And for years, the American Dental Association was assuring us that there was no problem with mercury, even though they were putting it into fillings. So, to get back to Karen's question, in the context of a modern society where there is mercury in the ocean, the water table, arsenic in the rice, and lead, of course, still kicking around in the water because of leaded gasoline, same problem, gets into the atmosphere, gets into the water, what is a person to do? You can test for mercury toxicity with urine or red blood cells. You can check red blood cells for lead as well. Low levels will show up as negative in these tests because everybody has a little, right? So the normals, the threshold that, say, if you go to Quest and get the test from Quest or LabCorp, standard analytic labs, it's going to be negative, most likely, unless you're living in Flint, Michigan, of course. Now, it's in your fat. It's not in your blood. If it's not in your blood, it's not in your urine. So you can also do fecal testing if you're worried about how much is coming off your fillings, like you've got a mouthful of fillings that are silver. you might want to get your poop tested to see exactly how leaky those fillings are. If you've got, say, a gold crown that when you chew actually attaches to a mercury filling, yeah, you want to get the poop test and see if it's at all positive, because you've got to work on your teeth first thing. Barring that, maybe you've only got one or two fillings, you might want to get a provocative test. And what you do is you take actually one of the drugs that we give to children with lead poisoning. They're called chelators. If you're looking for mercury, you tend to take one called DMSA, and it's dimercaptopurine sulfate and something else for the A. So I'll have to take the fifth on the exact terminology, but you get my point. We all call it DMSA. You take a dose of this, and then you collect your urine, and then all of it, as this goes through your bloodstream and gets into your body tissues and goes through your fat, it's like a little magnet. It picks up heavy metals. It also picks up copper and cadmium and arsenic and iron and zinc, and picks up all the heavy metals and some of the light ones. But you're looking for a real bump in your mercury level, and you have to work with somebody who knows what that looks like. But anyway, there is absolutely, that is the best way to check to see it, what's stored in your body. And everybody, by the way, has some lead and some mercury stored in their bodies. If I do this test and they come out with levels of, say, 2 or 4, I don't get too excited unless they're symptomatic. I put them on some techniques for getting rid of heavy metals. Maybe we'll talk about that some other time. And we're going to go to our next caller, and that is Ben in San Jose. Hello, Ben, and welcome.
Good afternoon, Doctor. How are you today?
Oh, doing really well. How are you?
Doing well. And I just wanted to make a few comments in regards to a question that you had fielded earlier on testing for heavy metals.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention, and I'd like some feedback from you also, when if a person is unsure of what their heavy metal content may be, and for now let's just focus on mercury, because as we both know, mercury is 1,000 times more toxic than most other heavy metals. I would say that as a first step to identifying potential levels, especially if you've had multiple amalgams or eaten a lot of seafood over the years, I would rather see someone go with a hair test just as a base initial test, because if a person has moderate to high levels of mercury and you start provoking urine tests with DMPS or DMSA, which is a sulfur-based product, it could potentially make someone very sick for months. But if you go with a hair test initially, at least you'll know what your potential starting point might be in regards to most heavy metals, including mercury, and then you can kind of take an approach from there.
You know, thank you very much, Ben, for calling from over there in San Jose. I really appreciate it. That's an important safety factor that I neglected to mention, that hair testing can be good. And basically, you'll get some false positives with hair, which you'll get some false negatives. It's been shown, and you may be aware of this, that particularly children with autism and people with glutathione SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, may have a problem effluxing metal into their hair. So some shampoo products and particularly hair dyes and other products might give a false positive. And also, sometimes you'll get a false negative in certain individuals, only individuals who have, you know, genetic problems. But of course, at least you're going to pick up most of them. So I think you're right. It's an important safety factor. And thank you, because I think in people who I really have a strong suspicion for mercury, like as in a woman I saw a couple of weeks ago who had 8 amalgam fillings and 3 gold crowns and some symptoms that were plausibly neuropathic in nature, that would be a patient that I should probably get the hair test first.
Yeah, I would agree. And the other point I'd like to make, if it's okay with you, for anyone out there who has, you know, amalgams still in their mouth, be very careful with the dentist that you choose, because most dentists don't, unfortunately, follow proper protocol. Many dentists still drill directly into the amalgams.
Right on.
Which is a horrific thing to do. I've seen patients with, oh my God, levels so high simply based on the removal of their amalgams. The proper way to remove amalgams, just so people know, is that you want to make sure the dentist offers oxygen, that they dam and block off the tooth, and that they make every attempt to remove the amalgam in one piece.
Yeah, I visited Dr. Christian down in Pacific Grove, and he actually froze the amalgam. This was my last amalgam, and he froze it and kind of pried it out, sort of the way you might chip epoxy out of a piece of ceramics or something like that. And yes, we did all of the other precautions as well. In addition, he had a chlorella, and I think it was DMSA rinse that he had me swoosh with and spit a couple of times after the whole process was over, just to try to capture, because it is a magnet, these things, that grabs the heavy metals. So I felt very comfortable with Dr. Craig Christian, and unfortunately, none of the biological dentists are cheap.
No, they're not. And another good precaution when removing an amalgam like that to take for a while is activated charcoal and bentonite clay. Mm-hmm. They're also very, very good as far as removing any residue, heavy metal residue, after a procedure like that.
Ben, you sound very knowledgeable. If you don't mind outing yourself, at least in terms of your profession, what sort of work do you do?
I'm an attorney.
I'm glad I put my disclaimer at the beginning of the show.
I hope that doesn't downgrade my legitimacy at all.
No, it means you're a smart. It means you're a smart person who can read. Who can read? So you definitely can read.
I do enjoy your show so much, Doctor, and I listen to you as often as I can. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. Let's see. One more email, I think, and then we'll finish up with some provocative stories. So this from Dan in Marblehead, Ohio. Love listening to your show and wish that there were more of them. When I hear of all the maladies that others suffer, I'm grateful for my health and really have no serious complaints. However, I do have a goofy number of skin tags around my neck that are rather unsightly. Is there an easy way, preferably relatively painless, to get rid of them? Also, I have advanced arthritis in my lower spine. I Nordic track 3 days a week and have since 1989. What can I do to reduce the pain and stiffness in my back and lower spine, hips, and knees? Thank you. I love your shows. Dan. Well, Dan, let's start out with the skin tags. The technical term for those is acrocordons, and there are a couple of ways to get rid of them. If you don't have a lot of money and they're reasonably long, you could just tie a string around them. Tie it tight or have a loved one do it as close to the base of it as you can. I might use something like dental floss to make it a little easier to tie. But anyway, you're going to cinch that really tight and then cut it off and then wait about 12 hours and then just kind of cut right above your string. In the doctor's office, I take one of those hemostats that we use to close off blood vessels, and I'll just grab the thing and pinch it. You could buy hemostats if you're an electronic person. You probably have some. And you pinch it. You let it be pinched for about 2-3 minutes until when you take the hemostat off, instead of looking like skin, it looks like clear plastic with the teeth marks in it from the hemostat. And then you just cut across the middle of that. The reason you're doing this is so they don't bleed, because if you just cut them off, they bleed like crazy and they come back. But when you do this, most of the time they don't come back, and that's a plus. You can freeze them. That has to be done usually at a dermatologist's office. And now I'm going to move to your back issues. First of all, you need to build up your core muscles, and the Nordic track's good, but sit-ups are also very good, crunches in particular. If you take a senior Pilates class, if that's available where you live, there on Lake Erie, that would be a good one. But you got to be careful with Pilates because it can aggravate your pain. Now, I think you should get an X-ray if you've got health insurance, and or the cost of an X-ray isn't that bad. But what you want to look for is to see how much evidence you have of disc disease and how much arthritis of the facet joints you've got. And if they see arthritis or they call arthritis, and not knowing your exact history of pain, it could be muscular or tendinous as well. So the thing you do for arthritis, however, is sour cherry juice, curcumin, and omega-3 fatty acids. And that's a kind of a magic recipe. You can buy the cherry juice frozen online, 2 to 4 ounces a day. Omega-3 fatty acids, that's fish oil. Usually ask people to take about 4,000 milligrams of that and make sure what you're taking has a lot of EPA and DHA. If you don't want to take that, that's about a teaspoon of oil or about 6 capsules. You can take lots and lots of flaxseed, but you're probably going to need a 1/4 cup of flaxseed run through a blender or a coffee grinder and figure out how to mix that in with your oatmeal or something like that. But your body will convert to to the powerful omega-3s, but flaxseed you only convert about 10% of it, so you have to do bulk. Same thing's true for turmeric, which is which contains the active ingredient curcumin. I usually want people to get a nice extract of curcumin, about 500 milligrams, but those are expensive. So if you're on a budget, you can get turmeric root and just grind it, or you can get fresh turmeric powder, but it should be fresh. You get a kind of a pasty thing if you use the root, mix that in with a little coconut oil or olive oil until you've got a paste, put that on some toast, and sprinkle it with fresh black pepper and a little salt. It's actually not bad. You can also mix that mixture, about 10% black pepper by volume, and you'll get enough curcumin if you're consuming about 2 teaspoons of the root and pepper mixture. So, not everybody has the money for supplements, and personally I see the supplement industry as kind of ripping people off. Well, that's not fair. Let's just say that some of the profit margin is a little higher than it needs to be. All right, well, let's move on to a little scary story. This comes out of Hebrew University of Jerusalem. This is a meta-analysis. And let me take a moment to explain what this is. The topic here is sperm counts, and there has been a lot of reports for years about sperm counts declining. This was a meta-analysis, which means that they took a look at over 7,000 studies, and they were very rigorous about the technique, the methods. Was this a good study? How well were the statistics done? And they threw out most of them. They kept 185 studies that met their quality criteria. And looking at that, they found a 52.4% decline in sperm concentration and a 59% decline in sperm count among men from North America, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand, but no significant decline in South America. Now, there were far, and Africa too. There were far fewer studies from South America and Africa, so it isn't as strong, but it suggests that there's something about our environment in the first world that puts us at substantial risk. And one has to wonder whether or not the sperm aren't the canary in the coal mine. The drop in the count, could that be a reflection of some sort of general toxicity similar to the toxic gas that occurs in coal mines that nobody notices until the levels get so high that you keel over? I also find it persuasive that this study, or rather analysis of studies, tracks in terms of the time frame. And we're talking about levels from 1979 to 2010 that they looked at. That tracks really well with the worldwide increases in diabetes and obesity. And it's also about the time that the autism curve starts going up. And there's a lot of factors in these things. There are a lot of other possibilities. Certainly, a lot is going on here, and it is likely to be multifactorial. But it seems to me that we need to really look at our environment. And I urge you, particularly young men, because, you know, we really want you to make healthy babies, and the sperm are being made constantly. A woman is born with all the eggs she'll ever make, and those eggs are tucked away inside her body, and they're very safe from the environment. But guys, that's not the case with you. And so it's so important to protect your genetic legacy, not to mention, of course, your own body. And like I said, diabetes is up. Let me just tell you a story, folks. When I trained, and this was in the 80s, there was no such thing as type 2 diabetes in grade school kids or high school kids. It would have been written up in the medical journals as an incredible anomaly. We never, ever saw it. And we had plenty of McDonald's and plenty of cars and plenty of people who didn't exercise. And I'll raise my hand and say I never exercised a day growing up that I wasn't forced to in gym. I was a real couch potato. But something's different. Something happened. And we have to ask ourselves what that is and really think hard about what each of you can do to protect yourself. And that includes, you know, thinking about your water supply, thinking about everything that you consume, and finding ways to clean it up. You know, simple stuff, folks. Don't microwave in plastic. If oily food is in plastic, it's going to absorb some of the plastic. If you're going to be drinking water, try to filter it. Try not to let it sit in a plastic water bottle in the sun. Try to see what you can do. As far as pesticides is concerned, you know, obviously rinse stuff. Try to buy organic when you can. If we can create a demand for organic, like I've seen in my own little supermarket over the last 10 years down in Watsonville, you can make a difference. You can vote with your wallet, and we can clean up at least some aspects of the environment, and hopefully make a difference for our children. I hope you've enjoyed this hour. I'll be back in a month, the first Saturday of the month.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.